Oi, oi, it's your boy, the Yusuf Zalal of keeping it halal, inshallah. Jack Slack, it's the Jack Slack Boycast. I'm still recovering from being ill, so apologies if the voice sounds hoarse or stuffed up. I won't make you listen to me blowing my nose. I'll hit the cough button for all of that. But best to just get back at it, keep working, and hope that I recover in between. Weird week. We got some interesting stories to touch on, some interesting fight announcements, some really sad news, and some happy news like Sam Alvey getting cut and Uriah Hall retiring. I think we'll start with the really sad news. I'll try and keep it positive slash infuriated rather than sad. But if you were following anything in the last week, it even hit the major MMA publications. Leandro Lowe was shot in the head in a club by an off-duty police officer who just sounds like the scum of the earth from everything that's coming out about this story. Just mental. This is probably one of the most famous people in jiu-jitsu. Very much a Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy. He was, you know, this happened in Brazil. He trains mostly out of Brazil. He still competes out of Brazil, despite being one of the best guys in the world. And yeah, he really just shook people's shit up. You know, this was completely unexpected. Everything you hear about Lowe was not, you know, there are guys like, was it Ryan Gracie? You know, guys like the court, sort of a dangerous lifestyle. But this one just, yeah, surprised and upset everyone. From everything I've heard about Leandro Lowe, he liked to be in the club and liked to be dancing, but wasn't a guy who went out looking for trouble or street fights or anything like that. Craig Jones said that, Craig Jones had a very famous ADCC match against Leandro Lowe, who wasn't the same no-gi that he was gi, and we'll get into that when we talk about his style in a minute, but it was still a massive upset for Craig Jones to submit the best guy in the gi in the world at the time, with a flying triangle, no less. But before that, Craig is known for heel hooks, or already was known for heel hooks, and he managed to get a good bite on Leandro Lowe. And Leandro Lowe was just like, no, I don't tap to heel hooks, mate. And apparently Craig jacked his leg up, tried to finish it, gave up, got the flying triangle later when Leandro Lowe was attacking a single leg. But Craig said, like, he busted this guy's leg up, and then the same night, because it's a two-day thing, ADCC, but the same night he was in the club dancing with everyone who also competed at ADCC. So he sounds like a guy who enjoyed a party, and respect to him for that. But yeah, this story is absolutely disgusting, to be honest. This off-duty cop, firstly, carried a gun into a club. If you're doing that, you're scum. But also was an off-duty cop, which is why he had a gun in a club. Goes over to the table with Lowe and his friends, takes a bottle of champagne or whatever they've been drinking. Lowe says no, confronts him, they wrestle for a bit, he gets the bottle back, and as he's walking away, this guy pulls out the gun and shoots him in the back of the head. So about as cowardly and bitch-like as you could possibly manage. And the really crazy thing is that the cop was a purple belt in jiu-jitsu, trained at some academy. You know, he would have known who Leandro Lowe was. And, you know, he initiated it. He took the bottle from the table. He was clearly looking for a response that would justify, or, you know, to him, justify getting his gun out. You know, shooting people in the back of the head and then claiming self-defense. It's very cop behavior. But, yeah, apparently, immediately was caught. And there were people on the streets outside the police station calling for his head. So Leandro Lowe, really well-liked, in addition to being an amazing grappler. But as a grappler, you know, I'm going to tell you to check out BJJ Scout. Obviously made his name with a couple of really good studies on Leandro Lowe back in the day, when he was just sort of coming up, surging through the brown belt scene, I think, and getting his black belt. Espen Mattison also did a really good one. And there's a couple of other really good ones on YouTube. He's a guy with, you know, near 200 matches, many of them at the highest level. And he kind of does the same things in every match. Not in a bad way, but in a damn, they know what's coming and he's still doing it way. But he was famous for his Toreando or Toreador passes, which are bullfighter passes, you know, where you grab both pant sleeves, trouser legs, as we call them over here, and you throw the opponent one way while you walk around the other way. And for his knee cut, and in both of those, he made sort of interesting developments. His Toreador, he grabbed the pants sort of on the outsides, but his palms would be on the middle of the shin. And I think BJJ Scout called them step and push Toreandos. But he'd keep his arms locked, take a step round to the side of the opponent, and then push into them from the side. So that was how he took his angle. He wasn't trying to pull their feet down to the mat and run round them. He wasn't trying to throw their legs to the side. He was taking a step out to the side and pushing them, which is a really clever move. You know, I've had a lot of success in my own grappling stealing that move. And I think I stole it basically when that BJJ Scout study came out, and he was just absolutely relentless with those passes. And the knee cut was another one, which is really interesting because you see guys do it no-gi and it does work. I mean, it's a really powerful pass in no-gi and gi, but in no-gi, guys tend to crowd up on their opponents. They get into what's called headquarters, which is where you step like into a deep, you step into their Delaheva and then too deep so that they can't get the hook in, and then you sort of squat down on top of them. But in the gi, they might pull your jacket to pull you over the top of them and start trying to pummel a leg in or start using some kind of spider guard. So in the gi, Lo would put one foot in and have the other foot way back, and he'd stand in this bent over stance with his legs wide, basically just sort of rooting himself to the floor while holding the opponent's pant legs and asking them to sit up into him. And when they did, he'd punch the underhook and dive on the knee cut. And the diving knee cuts were really quite a sight to see, because he'd get the underhook and he'd just dive. Well, I mean, the diving's in the name, but literally leap over the top of the opponent head first. It was really impressive to see. And the really impressive thing about it was that he made such committed attempts at passing. And then if he didn't quite get it, he'd just sort of fold his legs back underneath him into a combat base on one knee. And then he'd put his hands on their legs again and stand up into that headquarters position again. And he'd just go through it over and over again. And that repeated bang, bang, bang of knee cut, Toreador, knee cut. You know, it really tired guys out. He was sensational in his, well, always, to be honest. The no-gi stuff is quite interesting, though, because he never really found anywhere near the same level of success without the gi. And I was watching a couple of weeks back, I was watching his most recent no-gi match, and it was against someone who I wasn't very familiar with, or I'll say at all familiar with. And yeah, he was hitting these diving knee cuts and things like that, but he sort of lost control after the passes. And that was sort of true in his gi career too. He was a guy who could rack up enormous point totals, because he'd pass the guard and then he'd let them get the guard back and then he'd pass the guard again. But it's interesting because there was a little while where there was... there's always these debates going on in grappling. And Leandro Lowe's ADCC run coincided with Craig Jones and Gordon Ryan doing sensationally and sort of making a harder divide between gi and no-gi. That was sort of the beginnings of guys training exclusively for no-gi. So you've got people like the William Tacketts, or both Tacketts, all the B-team, all the New Wave Jiu-Jitsu guys, always had the 10th Planet guys. But like a lot of the guys who were doing well at the highest levels of no-gi after that 2017, 2019, I think it was 2017 ADCC, were almost exclusively no-gi guys. Gi guys, it used to be guys who won world titles in the gi, would take the gi off and then win world titles no gi. 2017 was when you sort of hit that hard divide between people. But now you've got guys like Mika Galvao coming back, who's great no gi and in the gi. The Ruotolo brothers are also great in the gi and no gi. Cole Abate. So I think it's something that people are always going to go back and forth on. But there was a similar sort of attitude to Leandro Lowe's passing after that 2017 year and 2019, where I don't think he even went to ADCC in 2019, where people were saying like, well, you know, Toreadors and diving knee cuts, just not suited to the no-gi game. And then Andrew Wiltsey came up through the brown belt ranks, and he's been doing amazingly with a knee cut that he basically says, yeah, I stole a lot of this and the details from Leandro Lowe. And I think he said that, you know, his big breakthrough was treating the knee cut as a position, as in you get your knee through, you get it to the floor and you have the underhook, and then you stop and then you start working for the finish of the pass, as opposed to you just blast straight through like Marcelo used to back in the day. But yeah, so it's interesting that that's come back, and there's sort of a no-gi Leandro Lowe doing the knee cut thing. And then the Toreadors, you know, that's much more reasonable for everyone to say, well, that's more of a gi thing than a no-gi thing, because you have the trousers to grab onto. But, and the aforementioned Andrew Wiltsey, who loves the knee slide, has also gone on record and been like, I don't believe outside passing works for no-gi. Yet Gordon Ryan is currently all about Toreadors and walking around people on the feet and then dropping into lower passing positions when they're scrambling to keep a hold of him. The Ruotolo brothers, I already mentioned, having great success working around people on the outside, because it's a style of passing where you're not giving them anything to grab onto. They're really good at keeping their legs back or using their own feet to trap the opponent's legs to the ground by stepping on them in ways where the opponent can't entangle them. So it's another thing that's gone, you know, there was an established thinking on it for a couple of years, and now it's changed again. But one of the interesting things about Leandro Lowe is that despite having not a super no-gi record, he does have a winning record against Gordon Ryan in no-gi. You know, it's he had a match with Gordon Ryan. I think it was a last-minute thing they did at the ADCC trials. They needed like a super fight or a main event or something like that, and Lowe was supposed to face someone else, and Gordon Ryan was there coaching, I think having already achieved an invite to ADCC that year. But he said, yeah, I'll do it, and Leandro Lowe actually beat him by points. So not super no-gi, but did beat the best no-gi guy in the world, or had a winning record against the top no-gi guy in the world possibly ever. And that sort of flows into the drama from the weekend, which was, or the last couple of days, which was that Flow Grappling were doing an event with Felipe Pena versus Gordon Ryan, which everyone was very excited about because Felipe Pena has a 2-0 streak against, or not streak, but 2-0 record against Gordon Ryan, and he submitted him both times. He's basically been Gordon Ryan's kryptonite. And everyone was looking forward to this. They were doing a time limit match, like their very first one, except Felipe Pena's best friends and longtime training partners of Leandro Lowe. So the Leandro Lowe news came the day before that this match was happening. So the match happened. It was a very weird match. Felipe Pena got up and went to the table to ask if, like, can I leave now? I've done the half hour. Because there was a lot of, like, shuffling around the morning of, what can we do? Can we reschedule it? Do I have to go? No time limit, whatever, this, that, and the other. They ended with like a tap to nothing. It's kind of like, yeah, Gordon Ryan got the win. I thought he was looking good, but it doesn't really, like, if that to him expunges the losses on his record, good for him. But the two impressive wins by Pena very much outweigh that one for me. And, you know, I saw a Pena versus Galvao at ADCC last year. You know, Pena did fine, but he did not look anything like his normal self because he'd had the flu. Now, the flu might affect you physically, but, you know, mentally you're going to be a lot more affected by your friend getting shot in the head. So it was very sad that all became like a big thing, sort of overshadowing that event. Realistically, they should have rebooked it, you know. How hard can it be to give people their money back and set another date, or not give people their money back and say, sorry, we're doing it on another date. I hope you understand someone got shot in the head. But ultimately, very sad story. The takeaway should be, one, fuck the police. Two, watch some Leandro Lowe. The man was a joy to watch. One of the very few people in the world who made gi exciting for me, which is one of the reasons that I stole so much from his game. You know, in addition to having that great BJJ Scouts study out there and a couple of others that I mentioned before, I could actually watch his matches and enjoy them. So by copying that shit, I was like, yeah, well, I've seen him do it 100 times. I'm not going to watch the minutiae of a Bruno Malafacine gi match or something like that to try and get better. And then sorry to do two deaths back to back, but the other one was I think a lot less tragic because it was an 89-year-old man. 89 years is a phenomenal run, any way you look at it. Jean LaBelle, judo Jean LaBelle, legend of the martial arts industry, legend of the Hollywood industry. Well, basically, he is the intersecting point between Hollywood and martial arts, and that's why Bas Rutten and people like that love him. But he's also big in the MMA scene because he did one of the very first sort of mixed martial arts contests. He was the coach of Gokor. I can't say his second name. Gokor, who also did a very early MMA contest and then opened Hyastan, which produced a lot of, it had a big influence on a great many top grapplers and MMA fighters. But if you don't know anything about Jean LaBelle, basically, have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? Because Brad Pitt is essentially Jean LaBelle. He was a martial artist, stuntman, occasional pro wrestler. He did basically every hard man job to make ends meet, but also loved being in Hollywood. And just a bit of a character. I remember reading, I don't actually own any of Judo Jean LaBelle's books, which is a massive oversight for someone who collects martial arts books and pro wrestling history books and things like that. Probably a bad time to start trying to do that now that everyone was remembering him in the next few weeks. But someone lent me a Jean LaBelle book years ago. I think it was called Pro Wrestling Holds or Submission Holds or something like that. And it was a mix between real, show and go holds, as they say, between real judo and submission wrestling techniques and professional wrestling techniques. And I'll always remember this panel that it was in the middle of the other techniques that it was like escape for an armbar, escape for a pin, escape for this, that. It was like quick escape. And it's Jean LaBelle. He might have even been wearing wrestling trunks, but he was wearing a hat and carrying a suitcase and climbing onto a train. And it was like, oh, the best escape is to do this in the middle of the night. And it was so funny and out of place in this book. And his books had a lot of weird little bits of humor like that that I really enjoyed. I need to find that book again, but I might even be remembering it wrong, but it just stuck with me for years. So a bit of a legend and much happier circumstances for his passing. Other news, Uriah Hall retired, which is a weird one. Honestly, I was quite relieved by that because the problem with being like a top 15 middleweight is that you can be not very good, but you're still going to be like pride of place on these cards. And Uriah Hall definitely had, gun shyness. Not even in his later career, just throughout his career. But some of those later ones were hard to watch. I mean, the Strickland one was especially hard to watch because he's supposed to be a good striker. And you can watch Sean Strickland, you're seeing him lean back at the waist, both hands out in front of him like a zombie. And you're going, how have you not worked out something to do here, Uriah? But he managed 19 matches in the UFC, which is pretty good. He managed to get into the top 15 in his division, which is, it's a bad division, but that's pretty good. So well done to him. Never really addressed all the issues that he had, technically. Had an amazing reach, and when he used his jab, it worked well. There was the odd fight, especially the Paulo Costa one. There was another guy he did it against, too. Just his jab looked electric, and then other times it would just be completely lost. Always circling along the fence too close with his hands down. I mean, that's how Brunson caught him easy. That's how Weidman caught him way back in the day. Always throwing spinning shit when he didn't really need to or probably shouldn't. And just a big moments fighter who couldn't really build towards things. So other news, few fight announcements. Tons in the middleweight division. Don't know why. I've announced it's my least favorite division now, and now they're doing tons of stuff with it. So you got Strickland versus Cannoneer on October 15th for guy to next get ignored in title contention. I don't know. You got Roman Dolidze versus Phil Hawes for October 29th. That sounds quite fun, actually. And you got Eric Anders versus Chris Dawkins. Hope Dawkins wins that one because Eric Anders has looked bad for about 5 years now. But a couple of interesting ones outside the UFC. You got Mansour Barnoui versus Adam Piccolotto in Milan under Bellator. That's October 29th. Obviously, Mansour Barnoui returning from a very long time off. Won $1 million. Fucked off. but yes, very, very excited to see that. Actually, another UFC one, Ricardo Ramos versus Danny Henry in Paris on September 3rd. That sounds good too. And then one's unifying its heavyweight belt between Arjun Bulla and Anatoly Malkin in September. Arjun Bulla has also disappeared for like 3 years after becoming agent Asian DC. And they pushed him so hard for about 10 minutes. And then he said, not happy with the pay. And they went, fuck off then. But the other interesting one is that Usman Nurmagomedov, having fought zero other ranked fighters in Bellator, he's taken on the champion. But that's quite good, because basically whoever takes on the champion next wins the belt. Because the champion's Patricky Pitbull, and I don't think there's ever been a less convincing world champion in Bellator's lightweight division. Unlucky to Tofik Masaev, who's already beaten him and is in perfect condition, you know, perfect position to take him on, just beat their number one contender in his first fight. Sorry, Tofik, you don't have the name. But anyway, let's talk about these fights going on this weekend. I think probably the most interesting thing that I can say about these fights is that they're happening in California, which, if you remember from last time, means that they have to release the payouts. And that was when they were in the public pay dispute with Francis Ngannou, and they decided to go to California with him, where they have to release his pay. So everyone went, oh, your heavyweight superstar champion is being paid $600,000 to show up. That's not a lot, given how much he's bringing in. But luckily that all died down, because everyone only remembers things from the last week or two. But in your main event, you've got Marlon Vera versus Dominic Cruz. Cruz still ranked in the top 10, wow. And Marlon Vera, well within the top 10, doing quite well lately. Big wins off old men, really. He's sort of mopping up in that division. Which is weird, because bantamweight's full of young killers as well. So I don't know why he has to fight, you know, Jose Aldo, Frankie Edgar. I mean, he lost to Jose Aldo, but Frankie Edgar, Dominic Cruz. He does have that awesome win over Rob Font in his last fight. And he got the win over David Grant. So yeah, not too bad. That Rob Font one was mental. I was rewatching that again the other day. And man, Rob Font, I don't remember him being fragile, because I remember him getting hit and being fine by other people. But he has something since that Aldo fight. It's just like, as soon as he gets touched, his chin just goes. Not that, you know, Vera and Aldo aren't big hitters, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone apply so much volume and then lose rounds on, like, one punch consistently. You know, one punch that put him into a defensive shell and let Vera tee off a bit, but still, you don't really see that. And Aldo did it to him too. It was so bizarre, because basically Rob Font did everything he should have against Jose Aldo. Apply some volume, try and take him deep into the rounds. And Aldo did what he normally does, which is swing back hard. But where it didn't work against Max Holloway, it did work against Rob Font, because every time he caught him, Rob Font just, you know, did the Bambi legs, stumbled all around the ring, looked terrible. Really strange. Going to be interesting to see what Rob Font does with the rest of his career. Maybe go up to featherweight, see how your chin holds up. Or if it holds up better, rather. Meanwhile, Dominic Cruz coming off the win over Pedro Munhoz back in, well, that was December of last year, and the split decision over Casey Kenney, who, again, wasn't really blowing anyone's socks off even before that fight was made. There was a very brief, like, media campaign to try and consider Casey Kenney the next TJ Dillashaw, because he did a couple of interesting feints to punches and things and changed stances a lot. But, you know, he lost that fight to Dominic Cruz, and then he lost to Song Yadong, and he's done fuck all since, basically. That was back in 2021, so yeah, he's been out for a while. Basically, all he was known for was, I mean, he beat Nathaniel Wood, which is a good win, and saying nasty things about Megan Anderson on Sean O'Malley's podcast. But that was crazy, because he went into that fight with Dominic Cruz, and you're going, yeah, he could win this fight. Because the thing with winning a fight with Dominic Cruz is that it isn't a technical thing for the most part. Everyone can low kick. It's the ability to fucking continue cutting the ring, moving him backwards towards the fence, and time the low kicks. The ability to feint into the low kicks. And almost no one does that. You know, Pedro Munhoz is supposed to be Mr. Low Kicks, and he was hopeless in his fight against Dominic Cruz. Low kick-wise, he did chin him pretty bad, and there is an awesome sequence where he hit Dominic Cruz with a left hook coming in, and Dominic Cruz was throwing one of those wide swings that has no stank on it. It doesn't hurt the opponent when it hits them. It just sort of brushes them because his fists are made out of the things that they make children's play centers with. And Cruz face plants and then quickly recovers, and he fucking arm rolled him into top position. It was amazing. I said this on Twitter, but, you know, he hits like a gentle breeze, but he's always been tough as nails, Dom Cruz. And in respect to that fight, actually, you know, you'll recall from when I was podcasting about it, but I was quite surprised how authoritative his jab was against Pedro Munhoz. His jab's always been a big weapon for him, but he actually looked like he was hurting Pedro Munhoz with his jab and his right straight. The big swings really are, they're anti-punches, to be honest. It's goes back to that, you know, there's these weird fighters who hit harder when they're bouncing around on the balls of their feet than they do when they're standing their ground, and there's fighters who hit harder throwing straighter shots than they do loading up big swings with their full body weight, they think, behind it. And Dominic Cruz is definitely one of those where he hits harder just poking people straight with straight punches than he does when he's swinging wide. But yeah, it was an impressive feat, him getting by Pedro Munhoz. And what you're seeing more and more out of him in recent years is that he got by on, quote-unquote, cruise control. But watching him fight guys like Brian Bowles and Uriah Faber, who couldn't get close to him. I mean, Faber got close to him by hitting him with a brushing overhand that he sprinted up into when Dom Cruz was trying to throw a knee. And that was a knockdown. And people were like, well, he got this close to knocking out Dominic Cruz. But for the most part, these guys couldn't touch him. You know, he's on the other side of the ring. He's letting them come in on him and clipping them with a wide swing while he pivots off. In recent years, you're seeing him have to bite down on his mouthpiece and deal with people giving him trouble. But it's tricky because, you know, if you watch the Cody Garbrandt fight back in the day, and, you know, I don't want to turn this into a reminiscing about that one time Cody Garbrandt had an amazing performance episode, but once Cruz was in the hole, he had no way to get out because he can't finish people. He has no realistic avenues to take, you know, to finish people. He doesn't take him down and get their back and choke him. He doesn't hurt people with his strikes. He could get takedowns. He's always been good at that, timing takedowns, but he can't finish off them. He's not the kind of top player who's going to get the back and finish from there or force his way to mount and pound people out. He is, and I say this in the most respectful way because I enjoy his style a lot, a point fighter. He looks at the criteria of MMA and he says, yeah, I'm going to do one of those and then one of those and then maybe one of those. No one looked more shocked when he hurt Takeo Mizugaki than Dominic Cruz. So this is going to be interesting because Marlon Vera, if there's one thing about him that might hurt him in this fight, it's that he starts slow and tends to start slow most rounds and then tends to rely on big connections and big moments. And Dom Cruz is not the Rob Font collapse like a flan in the cupboard whenever you get hit sort of character. I could see him getting hurt in a round and then winning the round. Judges permitting, of course. Vera against like Song Yadong, Davy Grant, those fights, you felt like Vera could really taken that person apart, but he takes so long to get started, even from round to round. Then he's got the task of cutting the ring on a guy who's going to change directions and feint a lot or fake out a lot. Then he's got the issue of the takedown. The other thing about Marlon Vera that you'll notice in all his fights, even recently in the Frankie Edgar fight, if he gets taken down, he tries to throw up triangles, which very seldom works at the highest levels of MMA, and it means that the other guy can stay on top of you for basically as long as he wants. Often lacks urgency getting up. However, he does have some tools that, or he has the technical ability to do things that really can give Dominic Cruz trouble. Think of the Sean O'Malley fight. Walking forward, changing stances to line up low kicks as the guy circles. That's the perfect thing to be doing against Dominic Cruz. Problem is, you probably want to be like double jabbing in or something like that to get him moving first. Otherwise, he's going to fake you out and go out the side door. So some really compelling matchups here, technique-wise and tactics-wise. You know, I think I can see Marlon Vera winning in a big moment, like against Frankie Edgar, you know, land a big front kick to the face or whatever in a fight where, you know, you weren't really doing that well before then. But that would be a Dominic Cruz aging out thing, I think. If Dominic Cruz still has the wherewithal to take shots and rally from them and make stuff happen, I think Barnevera's got a really hard task on his hand because he spends so long in these fights just giving up points and strikes and takedown attempts and things. So that's the whole card talked about. No, we'll do it. What else is good on this card? Co-main event is David Onama versus Nate Willand, where I upset loads of knobs, real normies on Twitter the other day by saying, lol, this is the co-main event. By which I mean, I'd like ranked fighters on cards, please. You know, you don't have to be a super picky old man like me to notice that these cards are getting worse. But Nate Landwehr is a fun fighter. David Onama is a fun fighter. He had a good one in his last one against that lad who came in at the last minute. They trained together before. His cage wrestling looked off the chain in that one. Meanwhile, Nate Landwehr's last performance, I was actually, pretty impressed by. Because he's, you know, if you watched his fight with Herbert Burns or even Darren Elkins or Julian Arosa, you know, he comes out and he fights like he's made out of wood. He looks like he thinks he's the biggest banger in the world, and he's not at all. But against Ludovic Klein, he actually looked pretty well-rounded, savvy. I mean, he won the fight by an anaconda choke, but he was showing some wrestling. His striking looked better. I was really pleased and impressed. And his post-fight interviews are always hilarious, which is part of why I'm such a fan. But, I mean, he's got one win since 2020, basically. And David Onama's got a couple of wins on the trot. Obviously way more active. They land where for some reason I imagine it's injuries. Hold on. Man, he was scheduled to fight Evloev at one point. That'd be a rough one for Nate Landwehr. But he was also scheduled to fight Makwana Makani, which would be a hilarious one for Nate Landwehr. If you can survive the first round, and then you just get to walk forward mean mugging and shouting, where is he from? Fuck. Clarksville? Knoxville. Clarksville. He goes, Clarksville, baby. Walking forwards and punching a very tired Makwana Makani with his hands on his thighs the entire time. I would love that. Hey, that fight could still happen after this. But yeah, if I'm Onama, I'm using that nice wrestling again. We banged out, what was his name? Benitez, a couple of months ago. If I'm Landwehr, probably, I would also like to see him use his wrestling. I think, I think he'd be a good match for James Krause, just because he's always going to be game and scrappy. But if you gave him that sort of formula where his decent conditioning and his tenacity could be used to rack up points and get positions, I think he'd do really well. I don't think he wants to be that kind of fighter, so, you know, that's a stumbling block. But it would be an interesting pairing. Yasmin Jirage versus Yasmin Lucinda. I have no idea who these girls are. Devin Clark versus Mukhzonov. I don't know Mukhzonov very well. And Devin Clark, last time I saw him, he was getting smashed by someone who probably shouldn't have smashed him. Oh, Ion Kutalaba over three rounds. Ariana Lipsky versus Priscilla Cachuera. They had to move this back because one of them missed weight by a good amount. There was talk of Ariana Lipsky not being in great shape backstage. So if you want to possibly win some money, bet on Priscilla Cachuera. But if you have an ounce of sense, you'll know to never bet on Priscilla Cachuera. Gerald Mearshat versus Bruno Silva. That'll be fun, actually. Bruno Silva had a banger against Alex Pereira. I thought he gave a great account of himself. You know, he was brought in as like a striking-centric fighter for Alex Pereira to style on. And he did a perfectly decent job. I mean, he lost, but at no point did I think he was super outclassed. He got hurt a couple of times, but, you know, he went the full distance with the most dangerous striker in the division and on the roster, possibly. And he landed some good lumps of his own. A complete change-up of styles for him, though, because he's fighting Mr. No Fast Twitch Muscles, Gerald Mearshat, close to my heart just because he's so fun on the ground. Mearshat coming off that loss to Jotko, but he was on a good little three-fight run before that against guys with European names. And then before that, he got flatlined by Khamzat in 1 second, basically. As always, it's Gerald Mearshat. How does he get it to the ground? Can he get it to the ground? Let's find out. Angie Hill versus Lupi Godinez. That'll be fun. Godinez trying to try and take it down. Hill's going to try and do herky-jerky striking on the feet. Lucas Bresky versus Martin Boudet. Fuck no do I care about this heavyweight fight. Nina Nunes versus Cynthia Caviglio. Caviglio, the third highest ranked fighter on this card. Kill me now. Gabriel Benitez versus Charlie Ontiveros. Okay. Odie Osborne's back. That's good. He knocked out that lad. Was it a Glory kickboxing champion or some shit they kept going on about? He hit a slick counter right hand and knocked some lad out in his last one. He's fighting Tyson Nam, who also, I think, knocked out the same guy. Battle of mid-level fighters there. Jason Witt versus Josh Quinlan. Know nothing about him. Yusuf Zalal. Man, how did he lose all his hype? He's opening the card against Damon Blackshear, which sounds like a made-up pirate name. Oh, God, he's lost three in a row. That's why he's... And all of them went the distance. That's why he's lost all his hype. Man, why is he still here? They're normally ruthless with that shit. Right, my voice is giving out. I promised to review Triple R today, but I've not finished it. It's so fucking long. I'm going to go home and try and finish it now. They've done the raid on the governor's compound, or I presume the first. Maybe they go back again. But with the one with all the animals, where the two brothers end up fighting. And, just getting into the backstory of, is his name Ram or Raju? The handsome one. It's so good. Watch it for next episode, because I'm going to be harping on about it. Especially these fights aren't any good. My voice is going, so I'm going to head out of here for today. Got my Alex Pereira Advanced Striking 2.0 firmly in the works now. Really enjoying doing that. That lad he fought. I think one of the interesting things about Pereira is that, firstly, his career takes off quite quickly. You know, I sort of ducked out of keeping up with Glory regularly after Last Man Standing. He was on that card, got easily handled by Artem Levin, and then he very quickly, like, reascended and became a really good fighter. And the other interesting thing about him is that he has fought a lot of guys multiple times. So he fought Simon Marcus twice. He fought Israel Adesanya twice. He fought Yuzuri Belgarui, whose name I can't say, but is really quite an interesting fighter, three times. And he fought Artem Vakatov twice. So and I think, did he fight Jason Wilnes twice? I can't remember. Yes, he fought Jason Wilnes twice as well. So he's got a really, as a guy who changes his style from fight to fight to try and pick up on things in his opponent, that's something else you really notice about him. It's interesting watching him fight the same guys again and try and work him out, or work him out faster than he did last time. But we got all that to look forward to. I'm hoping something fun happens in this main event and I can write a post-fight piece on Sunday. And in the meantime, you know where to find all my shit, because you're a boy, and I am your boy, Jack Slack, and thanks for putting up with me while I'm ill as shit and snotting in the mic. Getting well soon, bless.